Hello and welcome to the podcast edition of Ron Kaplan's Baseball Bookshelf, your source for news, reviews, previews, and interviews with authors and artists on books, movies, DVDs, collectibles, pretty much anything to do with the national pastime. If it fits on a bookshelf, it fits here. Marty Appel, welcome back to the Baseball Bookshelf.
Great to be with you. Thanks, Ron.
Congratulations on your new book, Pinstripe Empire, The New York Yankees from Before the Babe to After the Boss. Now, there have been a lot of books about the Yankees before, obviously. I would imagine more books have been written about them and their players than any other team. What makes your book different?
Well, it's a full history from 1903 through 2011. There have been some great coffee table photo books on the subject, but this is the first pure narrative history to cover their entire run in almost 70 years since Frank Graham did a book called New York Yankees for Putnam in 1943. So I'm very proud to have contributed this to Yankee Lit, so to speak.
Now, you mentioned Frank Graham, and I'm quoting now from your book where you say, he'd be surprised that in all these years, the Yankee story has yet to be told in a traditional narrative. So how would you define a traditional narrative?
Not a photo-driven book, but a text-driven book in traditional book size, 6x9 and a chapter book. So that's what we would consider traditional narrative.
You say chapter book. Now, one thing I notice, and the only complaint I have about this wonderful book, is that your chapters are generically numbered.
Yes. Yeah, actually, I'm on your side. We discussed with the publisher giving each chapter a title, but in the end, and I won't take you through all the machinations of the discussion, in the end, I decided to just use numbers, but I kind of wanted chapter titles, too, so... Anyway, I can live with that as the only criticism.
Now, obviously, you're a lifelong Yankee fan. Did you know much about the team's history as a kid, or were you only interested in the generation of players that you followed?
No, actually, I was interested in the history from an early age, and I actually read Frank Graham's book probably when I was 9 or 10 years old. So I love that stuff. I wouldn't say that was typical for kids growing up in the 50s, but I would say more so than for today's kids. My son, for instance, who's in his 30s, really knows today's baseball. I mean, he could name 24 players on the Seattle Mariners today, which I would have a lot of trouble with. But you ask him about pre-Don Mattingly, and you don't get much of a response. So I think maybe the baby boomer kids were better in tune with the history. And of course, you're only talking about a half a century of history there, not more than a century as we have now.
Now, you mentioned the baby boomer generation. There's always been this aura about the Yankees and Yankee Stadium. Whenever a visiting player comes, it's almost like now I've made it because I've played in Yankee Stadium.
Yes.
What do you think about how contemporary players know about the history of the game?
Well, they probably are pretty weak on it. At every stage that I've run into ball players, they really are not well-versed in the greats of the game. I think if there are 700 or 800 major league ball players today, and you ask them how many heard of Tris Speaker or Pie Trainer, you might get zero as a response. But they do know the majesty and the history of Yankee Stadium. They know that that's where they grew up, watching the World Series, watching important games, and hearing the announcers talk about all the immortals who had played there.
And what about the current Yankees? Is there anyone on the Yankees presently who you think are really enmeshed in the heritage of the club?
Well, I think Derek Jeter has become so because, first of all, every time he passes a great Yankee name on some all-time list, he becomes aware of them. And I think he always had a curiosity about the team's history. Now, Bernie Williams did a forward for my book, and as we were talking through what the foreword would say, I was telling him stories about, he was a center fielder, as was, you know, Mickey Mantle and Joe DiMaggio, but he had not heard of Earl Combs, who was the Murderer's Row center fielder and a member of the Baseball Hall of Fame. And the great Yankee center field lineage really goes back to Combs. So it was very interesting for me to teach Bernie Williams who Earl Combs was.
Basically, there are two eras I find in this book. There's before Appel and after Appel. Now, since you actually experienced a good deal of the Yankee history that you're writing about, which era did you find more difficult to write about?
I'm not sure difficult would be the word. I found it more enjoyable, actually, to write about the first half century of Yankee history because I was discovering things as I was exploring sources. And to come across a story like how they would give each other the hit-and-run sign by brushing the N or the Y on their uniform jerseys, which were separated at the time that they were the Highlanders, so they brushed the N for no or the Y for yes. That was a pretty fascinating little discovery to come upon. As I was writing it, and I got to the mid-50s, which was when I became a fan, I found myself feeling more secure about not missing any big stories because I kind of knew, you know, what I had to get in there. But before the 50s, you know, I was concerned that some major event had happened and I had somehow passed it by. But at the end of the research, I felt comfortable that I got everything in there that needed to be.
Was there one or two things that really surprised you about those pre-Appel Yankees?
I guess the importance of Jacob Rupert was a good discovery. I mean, we know he owned the team, and we know he bought Babe Ruth. But this man who's largely forgotten today, he bought Ruth, he built Yankee Stadium, he really created the Yankee dynasty, and he was as good a sportsman as America has produced. And he did this while going through Prohibition, and he was a brewer, and then through the Great Depression, which basically kept the industry stagnant and not able to grow. So despite all this, he disposed of other interests that he had. He managed to keep the brewery running, making near beer and keeping people employed. And he put the money and the profits back into the baseball team. So he was a benevolent owner, and even though some people remember him for never giving Babe Ruth a chance to manage, he really was a great Yankee figure.
What did you use for your primary sources for those earlier years?
A lot of long-forgotten, defunct newspapers that you can get at the New York Public Library, and also Sporting Life, Sporting News, the Police Gazette. There were a lot of publications that have long been forgotten that contained a lot of gems. I mean, I can still remember stumbling on a story when Yankee Stadium opened in 1923 that for the first time ever told me where the bullpens were. I had never known where the bullpens were in the original stadium, and then I stumbled on it in this one newspaper story. That was a great find for me.
Now, back in the 50s, there were still a fair amount of daily newspapers serving the New York area. So you were cognizant with some of the great writers of those years. Were there any writers from the earlier days that particularly stuck out in your mind?
Well, Mark Roth was an early writer who then became the Yankees' traveling secretary, and he was a great source to Frank Graham for the early years of the Yankees. So he was an important figure, and he also had a lot to do with naming the team Yankees as opposed to Highlanders. So Roth was an important guy to find, and I'm also in touch with his descendants, one of whom is also named Mark Roth. An interesting thing about Mark Roth was that he's the reason that traveling secretaries today get suites in hotels when the club is on the road, because Roth used to get the suite that was intended for Ruth. They would mix up Roth and Ruth. And so they finally decided, well, we'll give them both suites. So the traveling secretary started to get a suite.
Do the Yankees themselves have anything like a team archives?
Not a good one. George Weiss took a lot of personal effects and papers with him when he left the Yankees, which really was Yankee property. He shouldn't have done that. So, and when Larry McPhail moved the Yankee offices from 42nd Street up to 745 Fifth Avenue across the street from the plaza, a lot of stuff was disposed of. Mm. So the Yankee archives certainly don't go back very far. And even the photo library there, which I used to maintain when I was the PR director, is sitting in storage someplace in New Jersey and not easily accessible.
Does the team have an official historian?
Well, Tony Maranti, who conducts the stadium tours, is de facto the historian, and they also have a very capable young man named Brian Richards, who runs the Yankees Museum in the new ballpark. And those two guys really do know their stuff. I ran a lot of questions by them in the research for the book.
Because I'd imagine this is something that every team should have.
You'd like to think so, but I don't think any team's history is as interesting to people as this one's.
Now, as a former Yankee PR director, you know how some stories get embellished over the years. You know,
yes.
Holman goes this far or that far. In her book on Mickey Mantle, Jane Levy devotes a whole chapter to his tape measure home run against the Senators. How do you, in doing your research, settle on, for lack of a better word, an official version of a story?
I think I was pretty good on that. If I had my own doubts, I would present the story in such a way as to say it was reported that, or it came to be believed that. So I think the reader will always know when there's some measure of doubt as to whether the story was genuine or not.
That's well put. That's well put. Speaking of Mantle, that's how you got your start with the team, isn't it? You were his personal mail answerer.
Yep.
Once you started working with the Yankees, did that idol worship wear off at all?
Not at all. Not in Mickey Mantle's presence. I was always in awe to be with him. And sometimes I still remember driving home at the end of a day and having a moment where I thought, Mickey Mantle knows my name. How could this be?
you mentioned the photos in the book. With all the photos of the Yankees over the years, how did you select the ones that appear in Pinstripe Empire?
I wanted things that aren't generally seen, a lot of things that might create a wow factor, and things that I was able to give a caption to that would direct people to read more about this in the book. So I think the publisher was great in allowing two photo sections in what's still a very large book. And I think the photos that we selected, well, they've gotten some reviews on their own as saying that it was a good choices by and large.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but could you not slip in one of you in there?
Well, I'm in a lot of the narrative. It's interesting you bring that up. I mean, I was always cautious. I didn't want to overdo my own presence unless my being present for a particular moment added to the story or added to the credibility of the story. But I didn't think I needed to be in any photos. I thought that was unnecessary. Being in a story is one thing. Being in the photo just seemed like it was going overboard.
Because this is kind of like a chicken and egg thing. I mean, if you weren't involved as in all those years ago as Mantle's letter answerer and later as the PR director, this book might not have been written.
Well, I don't have like what you'd say are historic photos. I did have one that I considered where I'm actually in the picture when George Steinbrenner and Yogi Berra shake hands at the Yogi Berra Museum and bury the hatchet after many years. That was the only one I thought of putting in, but in the end, the others are just like picture of me with Mickey or me with Thurman Munson or me with Bobby Mercer, and there wasn't any narrative to really go with those pictures. It was just me and photos, so I chose not to use those.
You've written many books over the years, published by many different outfits. I imagine some have been better to work with than others from a creative and a remunerative standpoint?
Well, I really wouldn't measure the publishers against each other because each one had a different sort of book to deal with. Now, when I did the Munson book 3 years ago, I did that for Doubleday, and I was blessed and honored to have Jason Kaufman as an editor, who is the editor of Dan Brown's books, including The Da Vinci Code. And I remember turning in my manuscript and saying, Jason, do whatever you want with it. Just turn it into The Da Vinci Code. Bloomsbury, I liked a lot. First of all, I liked them right away when I found out they're in the Flatiron Building in Manhattan, that historic building on 23rd Street. And that's where the Yankee offices were when they were born in 1903. So I thought, oh, this is fortuitous. This is terrific. Clever. And the people there really knew their stuff. I had some great editors there. One editor in particular, I mean, he just was all over. He just knew everything. I had incorrectly identified Michael Burke as driving a Datsun 280Z, because it sort of defined Mike Burke's character. And this editor writes back and says, no, in the early 70s, it would have been a 260Z.
Wow.
The 280 didn't come along until 1978.
Oh, that's great.
So, wow, this guy is good.
Did you ever think of the responsibility of doing a book like this?
Yeah, because it had been 70 years since the last one, and I don't know if it'll be 70 years till the next one, but I was hoping to write a book that would be considered the definitive history. A lot of the reviews have said that. And given that responsibility, you really want to make sure you got things right. And to that end, I might add, Ron, that the chapters near the end that dealt with the creation of the YES Network and the building of Yankee Stadium, I so wanted everything about that to be correct that I actually gave those chapters to Randy Levine and Lon Trost and Brian Cashman, not for them to change the way it was presented, but to make sure that I got the facts exactly right. So I'm glad I did that.
Well, Marty, this is a great legacy of yours now, and you should be very proud of the work you've done on this.
Thank you so much, Ron. Thanks for doing this interview with me. That adds to the importance of the book, I think, because you're so respected in your field.
Well, thank you. You have a couple of appearances coming up you'd like to tell us about?
I do. I'm doing bookends in Ridgewood on June the 23rd from 1 to 3 in the afternoon. I'm doing Anderson's in Larchmont, New York, and an only Westchester appearance, 1 to 3 on June 16th. And one I'm really looking forward to, the Yogi Berra Museum at noon on June the 26th.
And details of those appearances will appear on the blog. We've been talking with Marty Appel, author of The Watershed, Yankee History, Pinstripe Empire, the New York Yankees from before the Babe to after the Boss. Marty, thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Ron.